Welcome. Welcome, friends, to ArtCast. I'm your host, Ron Jacobs, coming to you this week from the Architecture Insight Conference here at the Celtic Manor Resort in Wales. And it's a fine place with a lovely golf course and some rather gloomy skies outside at the moment, but we are inside where it is toasty warm with many of the top architects here in the UK. And on this edition, we're going to be talking about next-generation infrastructure with Richard Hall, the CTO of Avanade here in the UK. And it was a fascinating conversation with a guy who is very, very fired up about infrastructure. So I think you're going to enjoy it. Let's listen and learn something from Richard Hall.
Well, I'm Richard Hall. I'm Chief Technology Officer at Avanade in the UK. I'm from Manchester in the UK originally. I lived in the south for many years now. Originally a developer by trade back in the days when C, SQL, VMS, Unix were the open systems revolution. Certainly database applications were my forte once upon a time. And I've worked in consultancy. I've managed software houses. I've done interim management strategy work. So largely on the development side, but the last few years I've done a lot of work with CIOs around their infrastructure issues, problems, challenges, and futures.
Ah, okay. Wow. So that sounds interesting. Now, and today you're working for Avanade.
Today I'm working for Avanade. I've been there nearly 18 months.
Yeah.
Which could be old or new. We are growing at a pace, as I'm sure you're aware. We're just over the 4,000 mark now. We are the largest pool of Microsoft dedicated service people in the world, and we're working on some of the most exciting projects in the world. Some of them are huge, some are just challenging. All of them are fun. It's a very wide-ranging set of clients. We have no particular vertical bias. We work in public sector and private, in energy and retail and government, in utilities.
Just whoever's got the money.
Absolutely. Whoever's got the issue, the problem, the challenge, we've got the appetite, yes.
But you've got to have the money, too.
Well, the money helps, absolutely. But
okay,
we're delivering the value on it as well.
Yeah, that's right. Well, yeah, that's what it's all about. We're delivering some value. Now, we're talking today about, well, you're here at the Architecture Insight Conference.
Yes.
Here at the beautiful Celtic Manor Resort. I'm sorry, I did the Americanized version of that,
didn't
I?
Oh, yes, it's Celtic.
Celtic.
Yeah. Absolutely, we're Celts.
It's Celtic. It's so funny because, you know, back in the U.S., people talked about the Boston Celtics, you know, and all that.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. And you get that in your head. I should know better by now. Okay. But the Celtic Manor Resort here in Wales, and it is quite lovely. Actually, they have a beautiful golf course here.
It is. It's a well-known venue in the UK. It's one of the few that can hold, you know, some large events. And there's nowhere else to go to. So it keeps people here. It keeps them involved. It keeps them involved in the evening. The chats and the conversations in the back rooms will go on, I'm sure, as well.
So yeah, it's a great venue. So you're here talking about next-generation infrastructure. And infrastructure is the kind of word that could mean virtually anything. So help me understand, what are you focusing on?
Well, infrastructure is one of our key themes. And thinking forward, obviously looking at some of the trend lines, both commercially and technically, we're going to change the way we deliver IT, the way we behave, the roles involved, and trying to also take that forward view and play back to what decisions and impact does that have now as architects, as consultants, as developers, as administrators. What's going to change for us? How are we going to change with it? How are we going to be ahead of the curve? So you're absolutely right. It's a huge topic area. I think one of the fascinating things really these days is that the boundaries between classic infrastructure and application development, between SDs and SEs, is blurring. And I think that's a good thing. I think the more we have a bridge of understanding between those different communities, between people who build applications and design them, the people who put them into production, the people who administer them, the better. And I think there has been too much siloed thinking in the past, and that leads to consequences of infrastructure not being scalable enough, applications written poorly in unmanageable code, operations people being left in the lurch, not knowing how to best deal with a growing and thriving application. People are often victims of their own success in these sort of cases. So I think we can take a commercial and a technical view on some of these trends, happy to drill into that, obviously, and really inform our decision-making now.
Well, it seems to me in the past, many times these two camps of the developers and architects and the IT operations staff have almost been at war.
Oh, yes.
You know, and I have to confess that when I was a developer, that I'd never really thought much about operations. You know, I wrote the code, and we handed it to somebody and said, "You go run it."
I think you know, that was the classic, you know, analyst developers. Absolutely, they got requirements in their heads, they built something, they threw it over the wall, and end of their problem. And I think a lot of us had that mentality. I confess to it myself. That's certainly how I started my career in development. And I think what's interesting was, for me, a revelation came probably about 4 or 5 years in as my, from a developer into a consultant. A system I'd helped build and refactor was live and in production with a large number of investment banks around the world. And I was practically the last man standing who knew anything about the system that they could get their hands on. So suddenly I found myself on planes to Zurich or Frankfurt or Milan, often late at night, arriving in an airport, dragged off in a taxi, down into a data center several layers below ground. They said, "Right, there it is, you sort it out. Now, you've got 18 hours before trading starts again. Fix it, enhance it, do something with it," whatever the problem was. And suddenly you realize, wow, I really wish I'd built diagnostics in here, or I wish the architecture had more manageability features, or I wish it had been alerting me that something was going wrong rather than happening after the fact. Now, at that time, some of those things were possible. Some things were not easy in some of the technologies we were using back in the sort of mid-80s. But I think the point is, now, there's no excuse. There's no excuse not to design for operations. From day one, you should be thinking through, what's the impact of this code? How is it going to deploy? How are going to people know if it's running well or badly? How are they going to control and redeploy it? Even through to, how are we going to manage, archive? And the volume of data we deal with is so much larger. And we now have audit and compliance and regulations that tell us that we have to keep it and manage it and retrieve it and do something useful with it later, let alone the fact that the service envelope around a lot of these applications is growing, the demand, number of users, throughput, etc., is often surges far beyond our initial imaginations. We have technology that could let us scale out, but will the application let us scale out? Would it tell us when we need to? All those sort of factors we think are absolutely instrumental in good applications design. And one of the great things about being at Avanade is, of course, we have fantastic people from production operations background, from an IT infrastructure design background, and application builders. And the more we get them to work together, the more benefits we see, and hopefully that translates to the client. I think it also means that we can advise the organizations we work with how they can take on that same sort of mindset and view and break down some of these barriers. Because, as you said, there are too many barriers between these people, too much competition.
You know, it's funny because, you know, like you mentioned, the life cycle of data is something that many architects never really think about. I'm a very visual thinker. So what I imagine is, you know, it's like there's a pond, and the database is a pond, and we've opened up a large hose, and we're pouring water into that pond. You can't do that forever. No. Sooner or later, the pond's going to overflow.
Absolutely.
You have to have a way to get the water out of the pond and keep it in its banks and all of those things. But many people never design that into their system.
No. And then it's left to someone else, perhaps, to try and build a higher barrier or dam around it. And guess what? Even no matter how high you build, it will overflow in the end. So there's just a better way these days. It's, we can build some channels, and we can purge the water regularly and clean it and filter it. And we can take it away in containers. You know, we don't have to just leave it sitting there waiting to become somebody else's problem.
Yeah, well, and I would imagine that it's really helpful once we can bring these walls down a little bit, to have someone with that operational IT background to be involved in the project, you know, advising you about the thing you didn't think about.
Absolutely. And you know, what we found is developers are actually quite receptive. They don't intentionally do these things. They actually want to know how we can make their code better. Also, we are heavily building upon our ACA.NET framework, which is an aspect-oriented framework for .NET development. Now, with aspects, you can actually control these things somewhat independent of the code as it was cut. An architect can take more control. The operations people can feed into the architect and say, "I need these sorts of features." Basic building blocks like archive and audit, etc., should already be in there. But then instrumentation, data management, data lifecycle management, that's something that probably an application logic has to be built. but some of the ways that's monitored and applied in the code dynamically can be changed depending whether you're in a debug mode or testing initially, whether you're moving into deployment, whether you've got a deployed architecture then you want to test against. There's a lot of ways of working smarter, using the sort of software tools and technology that actually empowers more, and then just sharing that advice and expertise. And really, what does it come down to? It comes down to setting expectations. What we call operational excellence, you could almost call expectation management. From the very day you talk to the business customer, are you setting and finding out their expectations and setting them about what's going to happen to this system? How big is it going to grow? How secure does it have to be? How many users is it serving? How many years might it be in operation? Explain to them some of the choices. Understand what sort of service model that they want around it. Is it dedicated team? Is it shared service? Is it being administered by a remote outsourcer? Different envelopes of support and SLA around that, different sorts of controls and instrumentation needed. If you put that into the very first sets of conversations, you can help set the budget, set the timeline, and manage the expectations all the way through the development phase, pre-production planning and testing, taking that into production, setting up operational procedures around it. And then most applications I've ever worked with exceeded the life cycles they originally thought of. They went from 6 months to years. In very few cases, I think maybe telco industry was perhaps the most extreme example, have I worked with systems that had a three-month development cycle and a three-month operational life, and that was it. And then they were very obsolete. Most other sectors, you implement something, and it lasts for years, and it grows, and that dam is filling with water. What different modes would you do to scale it out? How you want to administer it? What do you do about planned retirement? Can you actually make it easier for people to refactor, to deploy new updates and migrations, and finally, when to switch a thing off? Can you make the data decouple from some of the physical architecture and logic? All these sort of aspects are absolutely key to good systems design. And then we look ahead to where people want to be with service-oriented architectures. I think we all realize that there are some quick wins we can make around putting a veneer of web services and technology exposure around existing legacy code. And those can be very important, very well worth doing, but we can rapidly run out of road when we try and get in deeper into some of these systems because the application, the functionality, the data, the management controls aren't there. Requires refactoring and redesign, or perhaps rip and replace. Starting ahead in the whole design process and thinking through the implications for anything we write now, that's a mandatory, I think. That's just good best practice. And then we can look at how we deal with legacy applications going forward.
See, you know what? A couple of months ago, I was up during the night with what I thought was very bad indigestion, only to find that by the morning I was doubled over on the floors, writhing in pain because my appendix had caused problems, right? And so they hauled me off to the hospital and hooked me up to every kind of machine in the world, you know. And being an architect, I'm reflecting on this later, you know, and I'm thinking about how the doctors are using the instrumentation of my body, if you will.
Yes.
To know what's going on. So I have all kinds of indicators of heart rate, respiration, oxygenation level in the blood, temperature and whatnot. And they can use this to diagnose the condition of my body. And, you know, it's funny, it's simple, but wouldn't it be wonderful if most applications had a likewise similar set of indicators so that you could say, well, how healthy is the application today?
Or wouldn't it have been great if sort of RON 2.0 actually had inbuilt early diagnostics that said, if I start to see this trend line, that's really quite exceptional behavior. And yes, it could be indigestion, but it could be something much more serious. Let's turn on a few more monitors and see what's really going on there. Let's maybe escalate to a few operation staff and get them to supervise this. Oh, wow, yes, you really are ill. Okay, let's take you down gracefully.
Yeah.
Let's bring up RON 3.0 in parallel to hand over the workload.
Sure.
Let's automate as much of that as possible. And then as we retire you, or perhaps we repair you, we'll see what we do. But in fact, actually, we won't do that tonight. It's not an urgency anymore. It's not an issue. We'll just keep you suspended. And at the weekend, we'll come in and do an operation batch maintenance. Now, we're working on some of the largest IT installations worldwide of any kind.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously they are all Windows, so but by nature of that definition, we're also working on some of the largest Windows IT projects ever attempted.
Yeah.
Now, we have machine rooms and data centers that are reaching limits. Thousands of machines being in certain farms, doing quite complex and diverse task loads.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's just not feasible in that operational environment, particularly with the sort of criticality of the data involved, to say, if a machine fails, we're going to send an engineer and do break fix on it. Or even it's going to take hours to replace and repair and provision something else. So we use tools like the automated build framework that Avanade developed, some of the new work we're doing alongside with Microsoft with DSI, and we have a new framework for that called DSF. What that basically lets us do is we can repurpose a machine in under 5 minutes. We could put a whole new bespoke workload, image, application, identity onto it. It could be physical, it could be virtual, really is irrespective. And what that lets you do suddenly is you have a farm of machines, you have a certain amount of contingency in there. If one or two start to fail, you just repurpose a few others with their unique identities and application mix. They're up and running in 5 minutes. Do you send an engineer that day? No, you don't. Maybe you do that night, maybe not. Maybe it's the weekend. You're totally changing the operational context, the SLA you can deliver with it. You change the definition of critical event. The fact the machine fails isn't a critical event anymore. It's actually something that's almost business as usual. You obviously look to the root causes for it, but it's not something you have to worry about. You won't be getting downstream concerns over it. And it allows you to run truly vast arrays of machines. And, of course, it's not just failure. It could be you're seeing trend lines that you need more web servers or more database servers or more application logic servers to be spun up to take the dynamic workload. Again, you can just re-image and repurpose that machine in minutes. It's a different way of working and looking at infrastructure.
Yeah, you know, it's almost just recognizing that in the real world, machines get sick.
Yes.
You know, they are going. This is going to happen. We might as well plan for it so that when it does happen, it's not like the big crisis I had with my appendix and had to call
Absolutely.
The ambulance and tell me away to the
exactly.
hospital. Right? It just becomes part of everyday. Hey, it's life. We deal with it.
And I think, you know, now we've got the tools that can enable that. We're now working up the food chain to say, how can we give application designers and infrastructure designers simpler interfaces to work with to let them define the different workloads and imaging, the different operational characteristics, the different metrics that they want to see in place, so that it becomes just a much more seamless process. Now, one of the things that we're so excited about, the sort of latest generation of Visual Studio, VSTS, is that it's starting to, A, break down some of those barriers between the different communities. And for the first time early in the development phase, developers and infrastructure people can start bouncing ideas off each other, do functional and non-functional testing in the same matrix of results, see the impact of different physical configurations as well as how their logic performs in some of those instances. And there is an interplay, there very clearly is. And bring that very early into the design cycle. Now, that's a huge step forward. Now, we've been working with Microsoft probably nearly 2 years and trying to anticipate what that will mean in both the development lab and also as it moves into production technology. We know there's some fantastic things coming as VSTS and DSI hits the operations room and new generations of tools to come in that area. But even working with just the things that have already been released, it's a huge opportunity to get it right first time, build in manageability, set operational excellence expectations right. We've developed what we call ACA lifecycle. It's a way of pulling together infrastructure knowledge and best practice, methodology, the development tools, and putting that in a common package to allow a team of 30 new developers to get up and running quickly so that all we can automatically deploy physical or virtual environments when developed with. We can automatically deploy physical or virtual environments for them to test against, and many of them. And if a few months into a project where they have various releases out there, they have to resurrect one to see what's happening out in a production system, they can do that at a turnkey process, know they've got the exact source code and the exact machine configuration to test against, affect to fix and proceed. And then we build in continuous integration and continuous testing throughout the lifecycle. Now, this is really turbocharging teams. It's getting them up and running from day one very quickly. It's giving them so much foresight of a consequence of their design choices. And it's allowing them to, you know, efficiently do application maintenance support application portfolio management without having to say, oh, wow, where is the source of this? What configuration was that server? Why do I only get that problem on that machine with that BIOS? You know, oh, okay, well, now we diagnose it. It took us a month to diagnose, and now we'll take another 3 weeks to resurrect the source code and build a new fork. We can take all of that away. And these things make, you know, a huge difference in productivity. And, of course, we're also getting to a point now with virtual architectures where we can say, why do we even need to build a physical development set for every new development project? Perhaps we can have a central set of servers where we're building virtual environments all the time, and we can leverage the Visual Studio and the test functionality and the project management all offer a central location for development teams that might be working worldwide. So all sorts of new avenues come open. That's the interplay of good design and development skills interacting with good infrastructure skills.
Well, you know, you sound way too excited about this. I mean, you know, you got to calm down a little bit.
I know. Well, I think, you know, it's changing the way we work. That's fantastic. So it's making us more productive.
Sure.
But the great thing is we've got huge interest from some of the early adopter clients who've now said, we want to use this on all our internal development teams. And it's been, the more we've tried it out, the more we've pushed the boundaries on it, the more we've got better and better feedback. And it found new ways of working and more productive ways of working. So I'm really passionate about dissolving those boundaries between the different teams and skill sets and skills families, SEs and SDs. I think we can take it further forward, though. If you look at the complaints I think we have around most IT estates at the moment, why is it that CIOs hardly ever have a good thing to say about their infrastructure? Well, partly it's because infrastructure is under huge pressure. We want to do more with less. We want to get better aligned to business value when it's not often clear what the business direction originally was. We're under more competitive pressure. We may be meeting SLAs, but are we really satisfying the users? That's a big difference. We're now also expected to comply with more regulation and governance from a business sense and regulation and governance from an IT perspective, and COBIT and ITSM and ITIL, all great things, but could easily become a checklist mentality and not really necessarily driving more value to a business. And the business is under pressure to meet those archival. Can you retrieve all your emails from 2 years ago? Can you keep data for 7 years or in some cases forever? And how are you going to manage that and rely on it to be then retrievable in 10 years' time? There's a lot of challenges there. And I think what we're seeing is and predicting is a real polarization. Commodity IT at one end, very standardized, very rigorous, quite possibly supplied by external suppliers into the organization, or as a central shared service utility model. And at the other end, real competitive edge, differentiating IT that adds real business value. And to be honest, I don't think there's going to be much in the middle anymore. So that has some profound effects on the way we build, manage, who does things. I think a few years ago, we saw some monumental outsourcing contracts, the entire of an IT department or the whole of operations being carved up, pushed out. I think partly that was because they perceived it just as a problem, didn't quite know what was going on, we'll see if someone else can fix it. Well, a great consultant once told me that don't try and outsource something you don't understand. You're only dooming yourself. Now, some of those projects have been successful, some not, but a vast majority, certainly in the UK, are up for renewal in the next 2 years. What do we think is going to happen? I think some will be renewed, some will be returned internally. Many of them have already squeezed out all the process efficiencies, resource saving they can. Some of those will be brought back into internal IT departments. Occasionally will be flipped over to new suppliers. But really what's going to happen is they're going to be chunked up. People are going to look at single processes, your HR functions, your finance, your administration, your logistics, your supply chain. Those are the things that could quite well be outsourced as a process completely, with all the IT that goes with it. Some of those are absolutely core systems. Some of them could be differentiating, some not. The fact that you need your logistics to work doesn't mean it makes any difference to your business value if your end product is your design value that makes you different. If you're a supermarket chain, maybe delivery really makes a lot of difference to you. You want to keep control of it. But we're going to look at whole different slices of IT and infrastructure and applications being passed outwards, and a few kept. And the ones that are kept, they're really going to want to see rapid differentiating value added to it, operational excellence around it, because it's going to be riskier, it's going to be more aggressive. You're trying to add new value, new functionality, you're trying to stay ahead of your competition. the IT estate and the applications team has to keep in sync and really deliver against that. And we're going to be challenged. It's not going to be easy. And again, the dangerous threat will be that someone else will come and offer to do that service externally to the organization. Architects need to be able to decide what are the things that should be kept internal and what shouldn't, and then how to approach them, and look at all the different things that complicate and add cost, not just the application development, but the whole life cycle of putting it into production and keeping it running. If they start to think like that, I think there's real business value, and the business will appreciate it. If they don't step up to that challenge, more and more will be sliced off and done as commodity.
Well, you know, it seems to me that as we move out more to service-oriented, loosely coupled kind of things, where maybe a part of the business process is handled by someone else entirely, the complexity of managing and monitoring the system as a whole goes way, way up, doesn't
yes.
it? It becomes a lot harder.
Well, that's right. And I think what we're already finding is people have invested considerable amounts in service management tools, and that tells them a certain process is ticking over. Maybe it even tells them it's an abnormally high utilization or low utilization, but it doesn't really tell them anything useful about the application's health, or is the business really getting the right number of business transactions through that it needs, or are we getting to close to the limits of capacity and we need to change the architecture as well as the design. We're almost drowning in that information. So I think people have got the early benefits of putting those monitors and systems in, but unless it's joined up back to the application design, and unless it's joined into the business and IT management, they're not going to get those meaningful diagnostics. If they are randomly taking your pulse and your blood pressure and the color of your eyes, you know, that's probably too much piece of information. If they want to know whether you've got an appendix problem, they probably want to do one specific test and find out. That test should be built in and easy to turn on and off, and everybody should know what to do. The operation procedures, the human part, should be lined up as well as the systems. And there's often a disconnect there as well.
When I have a part of my infrastructure outsourced, I mean, some people might look at that and say, hey, well, you know, the capacity and the monitoring of that, it's just a matter of the other vendor. Mm-hmm. And if I'm not happy, I just ring them up and say, fix it, whatever you have to do.
Yes.
But I think that puts me at the mercy of the other vendor to some degree.
Well, I think it does, but that's almost, I think that's what has happened in the past and what I think we're trying to move away from. I think if you outsource a business process and someone's responsible for delivering a certain number of new recruits a month or a certain a number of well-settled transactions for a bank payments division, it's up to them to meet that standard. Whatever they have to do with their IT to meet it, because it's now their IT. It really is. It may be sitting in your premises in part. It may be linked in across certain shared services and networks, but ultimately, it is their issue to resolve. Now, obviously, that requires a certain degree of sophistication, because when we're crossing boundaries and shared responsibilities, those have to be very clear. But ultimately, the business imperative is on the person supplying the business process. It shouldn't just be they're taking care of the IT and not the process, because that's decoupling it. And that really, there's nothing good can come really of that route. And I think we've seen the sorts of problems and issues. So I expect fairly confidently that I think 70% of the major outsourcing contracts are going to be renewed in the next 2 years. I think many of them, when they are renewed, will be chunked into separate process and IT chunks, given to different outsourcers, some kept back internally, but all of those teams, including the internal team, will be challenged to deliver very specific business results, however they can, with a budget and a timeline involved. And they're going to have to understand the relationship between their development process and the infrastructure estate and the operation procedures to know where the cost is, where the problems are, how to smooth that pipeline. And they're going to have to know, can they do it in-house or not? Is it going to be, just because it's vital doesn't mean someone else can't do it. I think we've learned that lesson. We have a project that serves, I think, 70% of the discounted airlines around the world. They run on a common infrastructure for their reservations and bookings and control. Why? Because it's not differentiating. Better yet, every time they innovate, they all share in the innovation. So they've lowered their cost of maintaining and developing that application, and they all reap the benefits. Because what are they? They're low-cost airlines. They want to drive costs down and give a simple service to as many clients as they can serve. That model wouldn't fit all our clients. Some know that what they're doing, particularly, say, in investment banking or telecoms, is unique. And if they're not staying ahead of their competition, or they're only doing the same as, they're getting very little value from their IT or their business process. So they're looking to innovate, they're looking to take risks, but they also have to rely on it. It's getting critical now. and you know, we're working in enterprise Windows, enterprise Windows services and solutions. That's all we do. The challenge has been, though, the expectation and capability of what Windows can do in the enterprise is rising and rising. We have to keep pace with that. And some of the things we've lost from the mainframe era was a sort of certain operational discipline and a sort of mission-critical culture. It's actually possible to do that with Windows servers. It's just people often don't remember that it's possible.
Yeah, you know, that's when you get to the, where's the server? Oh, it's under George's desk over there, right?
Or why is it, you know, you walk into an IT shop and find 52 people have the administrator password. It's not necessary. Why? It's just a culture of, oh, we're going to make a change and we'll let it happen because it's just Windows, right? That may have worked when it was under your desktop or even a departmental level. It just doesn't work anymore when a whole business or a whole division is running on this sort of thing. Yeah. And I think if we bring the level of human process up and expectation management, we'll deliver better and better systems and the infrastructure will be relied upon. And guess what? The business users are going to turn to us for more demanding and challenging projects. At the moment, they're just complaining about what they have. If we can take that pain away, show them a better world, carve it up and say, yes, some of these things are best done by other people. These are the things we're going to do in-house. These are the things we're going to build value into and be seen to do it. That's what next generation infrastructure is really about.
Well, thank you so much for stopping by. You really...
It's a pleasure.
Wow. What can I say? Richard Hall, ladies and gentlemen, from the Architecture Insight Conference here at the beautiful Celtic Manor Resort in Wales. Can you sense the passion in his voice as he talked about this next generation infrastructure? I think these Avanade guys are onto something. There's so much to think about, but you know, these are the kind of operational considerations that a mature architect will think and plan for. You know, I mean, having the ability to monitor the health of the system and to be able to manage those failures that are going to happen. They're going to happen. Well, that's what we have to do. And that's why we're here thinking about it on ArtCast.